Welcome to a sound effect podcast, the podcast about sound effects. My name is Christian Halskjær.
And I'm Asbjørn Andersen. We're back.
That's right.
Time flies, and it's been a year since we launched the podcast, actually. Christian, you've been hard at work putting this new episode together. Can you share a few details about what you have in store for us?
Well, as usual, we've been rounding up some of the newest sound effects collections that are available over at soundeffect.com, and we're going to talk a little bit about those, and a lot of really interesting sounds included.
Christian, you've also been speaking with Paul Verostek, who was on our very first episode as well, and he's sharing his take on what's happening right now in independent sound effects.
That's right. As you know, Paul really knows what's happening in independent sound effects and blogs a lot about it. So I asked him what's been happening in independent sound effects for the last year or so, and how the whole scene, if you like, is developing, and where he sees things going in the future. And he had a lot of interesting things to say about that.
Anything else in store?
Well, yes. As a matter of fact, I have another little travel montage for you guys. This time it was actually a family vacation to the Greek island of Crete. I tried, as usual, to record as much as I could, and that didn't all go as well as I had planned. So this is sort of a little story about that and some sounds from down there.
Awesome. That sounds really good.
Let's get to it. As always, there are plenty of new sound libraries over at soundeffect.com, and I'm going to present you with a small selection of them. First up is Rotation by Collected Transients. And this is a sound effects library that's built for sound design, primarily, I think, centered around things that spin and rotate. In this collection, you get about 200 different sounds, about 9.4 gigabytes of sound files, I believe. And what it is it's a range of props that all somehow rotate, everything from ball bearings to trash cans, and all recorded at 192 kilohertz sampling rate. Let's have a listen. Next up is a library called Sword Fighter by Squeaky Fish. And this is all about sword fighting, obviously. You get a lot of different sword type sounds and a lot of variation here. You get a lot of different swing sounds and hits and swooshes. You also get some knife throwing sounds as a sweet little bonus, and different impacts. And it's a little bit of a construction kit, kind of. But check it out. Big Machines by Shaping Waves is a collection that consists of recordings of what are said to be rare old industrial machines from German power plants and other industrial sites. And this is everything from huge power switches to generators and other strange machinery with such exotic names as coal dispatcher, motorized throttle flap, and here's another one. Oil atomizer. I love those names. This is all recorded at 192 kilohertz sample rate again, and with microphones that give you extended frequency range up to 50,000 hertz. Again, a lot of potential for pitching down. Let's hear it. Thank you. finally, we have African Wildlife from Don Hendricks. This is a collection of wildlife and nature sounds recorded in Zimbabwe, Botswana, and Namibia. You get four categories of sounds covering mammals, birds, ambiences, and insect recordings. So a lot of different animals, a lot of different sounds, and a lot of adjectives here. As according to the description, you get sounds that are screaming, barking, growling, roaring, breathing, grunting, feeding, hooting, warbling, and so on. A lot of expressiveness here. You get a lot of extensive metadata about locations and species, and all in sound minor format, clocking in at 6 gigabytes total. Let's have a listen. As Asbjørn said, we had Paul Verostek on the very first episode of the show, and that was about a year ago. And since we all know how much has changed on the whole scene of independent sound effects, we thought it would be a good idea to talk to Paul again and hear what he has to say about the development in independent sound effects over the last year. So hi, Paul, and welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me back on the show. As you can probably tell, I've got a bit of a cold, but I'm really happy to be here and talk to you about indie sound effects libraries.
Great, great. I'll try not to go too hard on you. But let me just start out and ask you, in terms of independent sound effects, the whole development there, where would you say things stand today?
Well, that's a good question. A lot of activity has happened in the past year or so, and there have been some pretty big changes. The first one I think that I've noticed has been a lot of the more established libraries have slowed down their release schedule. They're releasing still, for sure, but maybe not as frequently as they have in the past. And what has kind of complemented this, I guess, is a lot of new libraries have come on the scene, and there's been a huge burst of releases from these people, where in the past, maybe new people would have released one or two new libraries a year. There have been a number of different sound effects web shops that have released 5, 6, 10, 12 new libraries all within the span of the year. So there's been a huge amount of productivity. The third thing that I've noticed has been that the corporate sound effects libraries have been releasing bundled sound effects libraries in the indie format and releasing them on sound effects websites. So it seems like they're catching on to the power and the method of expression from packaging sound effects in this way, and they're starting to duplicate that and release parts of their collection in that way as well.
Right, okay. So what would you say have been the biggest surprises to you in the last year, and have there been any releases that have impressed you in particular?
Well, I think it's been a pretty surprising year all around for the three reasons that I just mentioned. One thing in particular has been how corporate sound libraries have changed quite a bit. And I know that doesn't really affect our conversation about indie sound libraries, but it's interesting just the same in what it may imply for the future. So let's say about 3 or 4 years ago, anytime you typed in the keyword sound effects into Google, some of the first websites that would pop up would be the corporate sound libraries, the ones that would make CDs, the ones that would have hundreds of thousands of a la carte sound effects that you can buy individually on the web. They'd appear right there on the first pages of Google. You can't find them anymore. You have to go maybe 3 or 4 pages deeper into the search results to be able to find their websites at all, which is actually quite astounding.
Yeah.
Given the amount of content that they have, that Google's no longer ranking them higher. kind of shows the relevance of those sound libraries and how people are responding to those type of websites. Now, you might be wondering what's replaced that. A lot of them have been search results for free sound effects libraries, and some indie sound libraries have popped up as well. But the fact that there is a change going on overall, it just implies a shift for sure. As for favorites, I mean, I do contend that releasing anything at all by any individual field recordist or sound designer is a huge victory. To be able to collect your work, your personal work, and be able to put it on the internet and offer it for other people and for the community is a huge, huge plus. So I applaud everyone that's released sounds, and there's been easily 500 or 600 new libraries in the past year alone. So congratulations to everyone. I think, personally speaking, the libraries that catch my eye are the ones that are doing something a little bit different, whether it's in their branding or the subjects that they release or the thought that goes behind it. And I think one that really caught my eye was from Collected Transients. It's a library called Rotation. And the people over there really put a lot of thought into making that sound library. And they wrote a 2 or maybe 3-part blog post about it on their website. So if you want to check that out, I'd suggest to listeners to Google that and track that down. Really interesting way of approaching creating a new sound effects library. So I thought that was quite cool. I mean, I have great respect for everyone that's been creating sound effects libraries already. There's an amazing amount of content there. Some of the ones that are catching my eye personally would be some of the newer guys with some of the smaller sound libraries, I suppose. But even though they're smaller and the release schedule may be slower, I still admire what they're putting out and the way that they're doing it. And some of those people would be the Soundholder, 3Maze, Shaping Waves, Sonic Salute, Mindful Audio, Norsonant. And Brandon Sabuth Audio really releases some interesting stuff as well, with some great stories behind what he's doing. So I find that these people are pushing the edge of things. They're taking new approaches. They're keeping ideas fresh. And that's a great compliment to everyone else who's also releasing sound libraries as well. I don't really want to play favorites here, but those are some of the ones that caught my eye personally and in particular.
That's noted. Another thing, there are a lot of new players in indie sound effects these days, and in fact, it's pretty much exploded, I'd say. So what would you say that means for indie sound effects generally, and what would it take to stand out today?
Well, obviously, there's a lot more content out there, which means there's generally going to be more competition. And what it's meant has been that a lot of creators have had to adapt more. Like the people I've mentioned in the last question that you asked, they are trying different approaches, new subjects. Even if they're small libraries that don't charge a lot, they're kind of pushing the edges a little bit more to do different things, new angles, not even just in the sounds, but how they're presented, the marketing, the logos, the websites themselves. Sometimes it's sales models. Sometimes they're asking for donations. They're not even asking for cash. Some people are releasing things for free because they want to get their material out there. So all these different things, or all these different methods, rather, are just a way to stand out. So you have to kind of think a little bit differently, try new ideas, not be afraid to shake things up, and take some risk as well. That's definitely what you're going to have to do to be able to get noticed and to succeed, I would say.
That makes sense. So considering that, would you say that the increase in all these new libraries and makers, has that affected the way you approach your own sound effects and how you produce new collections and market and such?
No, it never does, because in terms of subject, definitely not, because I record certain subjects because I have an affinity for them personally. So that's not something that's really impacted by the market. I always like recording fighter jets or race cars or really strange machines or interesting motors and things like that. My interest in those things are part of who I am personally, and my understanding of the subject and how I like to express myself through those types of sounds and capturing them. So it's a personal type of expression. Even if someone was to capture the same subject, and I encourage them to, there's so many great sounds that are out there. Designers need more versions. Go for it. Totally go for it. But for me, the way that I record personally, and of course there's not just one way to record any given sound effect, the way that I record personally, I feel, is linked to who I am as a, I don't want to say artist, I never really liked that word, as a person who creates, maybe. And I feel that because of that, I will record in a way that will be unique to me. So I guess generally speaking, I don't really base many of my decisions on what other sound libraries are doing. I notice what everyone else is doing, and I really respect the effort that everyone is putting in, and I really admire what they're creating. There's some amazing libraries out there. What's most important to me is that I have a fulfilling experience creating, and of course, probably the most important thing is that my customers are happy with what I'm putting out there, and what I'm putting out there is useful to them.
You talk about doing your thing, but even with that personal focus, what would you say are some of the areas that new sound effect creators should focus on in terms of, say, equipment or techniques or new emerging audio formats and such?
I think that's a really excellent question. And I think answering that question requires a bit of a perception shift on the side of sound effects creators.
Okay.
I think thinking about skills, formats, and markets, it's a bit of a limiting way to think about how you create sound effects libraries. Now, of course, you're going to think about that maybe when you begin. I think that's very typical. You think about what skills you have, what kind of formats you want to offer, and who you want to sell it to. I think that's all great. But to release a sound library that would be more personally fulfilling and more successful to the listeners and the people that want to use those sounds, I think it's best to incorporate a new strategy. An example I use to illustrate this is by talking about visual art. So let's imagine in a city that there are a number of art galleries. In gallery number one, it's all filled with paintings by Picasso. In gallery number two, it's filled with paintings by Monet. You would never say that these two galleries would compete. Why? Because the painting styles are so radically different that you couldn't even begin to compare them. And I think this is the way that sound effects creators should start looking at field recording and sound design in general. Now, why does this not happen already? I think the reason is that the majority of sound libraries are recorded technically, and that's reasonable. It's difficult to record sound. You have to select your microphones. You have to set them up properly. You have to perform it precisely and accurately so things don't peak. So as sound creators, we begin our journey of exploring sound by thinking about things in technical terms. You have to. There's no other way that you can capture a sound effect other than by using highly technical gear that costs thousands and thousands of dollars. It's very natural to begin recording sound and creating sound effects libraries with a technical mindset. I think that's necessary, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with it. We've all done that. But I think it's necessary to step beyond that and do something a little bit more. If you record sounds just technically, you set up the microphones absolutely perfectly, and you perform a subject exactly the way you want to, you risk falling into the trap of being replaced. Now, why would that be? Well, anyone, given enough time and enough money, will be able to assemble the right amount of microphones, arrange them in exactly the same way, and capture the same sound effects just like anyone else has done before. So to be able to remain viable, as well as fulfilling and offer something new, you have to add something a little bit more than that. The solution, of course, is to add something that is unique. And that thing is the sound creator themselves. The field recordist and sound designer has something unique to offer. Why would that be? Well, we're all different. We all have a specially highly attuned creative sense. We all appreciate different forms of art. There's no two people that will be alike. The goal, I believe, is for every sound pro to bring this to the sound libraries they create. Now, what would the result be if people started doing this? Well, the result is that the pro will be able to escape competition. relying on mic stats and tech specs, that invites replacement. Anyone can do the exact same thing and create the same sounds in the same sound library. And of course, that's not good for success or even for sharing for the rest of the community. Nobody wants duplicates of anything. So to be able to create something new, adding a unique creative element drawn from the Sound Pro themselves will allow the sound creations and the sound library as well to escape the trap of competition and replacement and offer something new and interesting to the community.
Yeah. So when you take a look at the indie sound effects landscape, you see a lot of sound effects creators releasing libraries into categories that are perhaps already pretty crowded. There are a lot of similar libraries out there. So how can new sound effects creators avoid doing the same thing that everyone else is doing? What's a good way to get ideas to avoid this?
Well, again, this kind of touches on what we were talking about before, that thinking about ideas goes beyond just choosing a subject. So it is a little bit limiting to say, well, you know, I've got to find a completely unique sound that has never been recorded before.
Right.
Instead, I would encourage sound designers to, as I was saying before, try and put some personal element into the sounds that they're creating. So it may be that the sound designer has a different perspective on how to re-record a subject. So let's say your father loved cars and he was a mechanic. And so every Saturday you're helping him fix cars. And so you know cars inside and out, how to tweak them, how to tune the engines. You can bring that creativity and your knowledge to the sound effect library that you're recording, offer that, and have something new. Now, there's so many people who are recording cars. Are you going to run into trouble with that? No, because you're bringing something new that you have. You alone have that experience that you're going to bring something new and bring that to the library that you're creating.
Right.
On a more technical level, you could record with different techniques using a different perspective. Some libraries have been offered that have recorded typical ambiences, but through walls, like an offstage library, so there's something new there. Or you could use different microphones, like contact microphones or other different techniques, hydrophones and things like that. So there's a lot of different ways that you can explore even existing subjects. So I would encourage people not to just think about trying to find new subjects, but to see what existing ones interest them already and try and take it from a different approach. That's maybe an easier way of doing it. Other people are doing different things, so different payment models, different way of charging or sharing, and also in presenting on their websites as well. So I think there's a lot of territory that you can explore. If you think about it a little bit differently, I would not get discouraged if you can't think about a completely new subject of sound that you've never heard recorded before. Don't worry about that. The main thing is to go out there, keep recording, and maybe try and put your own little personal spin on it or a different technical spin on it, and then try and offer that to the community.
Right. Good points. So to sort of continue in the vein of trying to set yourself apart, you might say, I'd like to bring up the somewhat boring subject of metadata, and I simply want to ask you what good metadata looks like and why it's important.
So metadata, in terms of sound libraries, is additional data beyond the information of the sound itself. So typically, metadata regarding sound is additional text, although images is also used, and sometimes GPS location and things like that. So metadata is used, or text metadata is used in terms of sound effects libraries, to be able to help finding them. So as you can imagine, many sound designers and creators and sound pros have huge sound libraries, and being able to find the right sound quickly, choose it, and get back to work is not always an easy task if you're just using the file name. So metadata is used so that you can narrow down your results and choose the exact sound that you need and get back to work creating.
Right. So if I wanted to make the best possible metadata, what would that look like?
The best metadata is full and complete, so you have many different fields filled out from the name, the description, category, subcategory. It's unique. You want every record to be completely different from every other one. Otherwise, you don't want to search and find two of the same thing, naturally. You want to be able to find something that's completely unique and make your choice easier. And it also allows inference, so being able to look across the fields and understand what the text is telling you a sound is sounding like. And that's the true test of really good metadata. The best metadata, in regards to sound anyway, allows you to imagine what the sound is like before you even listen to it. And why isn't that important? Well, being able to interpret a sound, you have to be able to listen to it all the way through, and that's not necessarily practical when you're listening to 5-minute long ambiences. So what you use metadata for is to be able to read the different data and infer what the sound is going to be like, so you don't have to waste 5 minutes for every traffic ambience that you want to lay into your project. So metadata is a very powerful tool to help you understand what the sound is, make the choice, get it into a project, and get working, get back to creating as quickly as possible.
So if you're new in sound effects, you might be wondering how to do this, how to actually embed metadata into sound files. So how would you recommend sound effects creators go about implementing metadata in their libraries?
Well, the first point that I think is helpful to make is that adding any metadata at all is a huge, huge step. So I've seen a lot of sound libraries with no metadata at all. And as you can imagine, they're very difficult to work with and very difficult to search. So the one thing that any sound creator can do is to start with the file name. That's free. Doesn't require any software at all to be able to have a rock solid file name that gives you, that's unique, that's diverse, allows inference, and allows you to understand what the sound is about. That's always the first place to start. And I think it's very important to think of metadata in terms of the file name. And I know this may seem a little bit basic, but to think of the file name first, because a lot of people jump the gun and they start filling out 20 fields of metadata and you don't start with the basics first. Filling in a lot of different fields of metadata isn't necessarily helpful if the data itself is not very good and it's not very helpful and it doesn't allow searching. So my advice is to be able to start small was something that anyone can do with the file name and build on from there. Always start with that first.
So like you said, that's a good start, but what do you do if you want to move beyond that, say?
Well, this is where things can become confusing for new sound library creators. The range of options is pretty vast. There are proprietary options that create metadata that can't be read by any other software. Just the same, this can often be a good choice because the proprietary options have a lot of power and they have a lot of fields of metadata and they can help searching considerably. Now, I think the proprietary metadata software is a good goal to aim for. Generally speaking, that will be the choice of professionals and it should be something that every sound library creator should aim for. However, it's not completely feasible when you're starting out writing your first libraries. It may be beyond the reach of casual sound library creators. As far as expense and technical requirements and learning curve. So aim for that and aim to have knowledge of that for something later in your career. But again, the main idea is to get your sound library out there as quickly and as professionally as possible. And one way to do that is to begin using free formats, metadata formats, and grow from there to the proprietary ones. Now, as far as free formats are concerned, you would have things like iXML and B-Wave. Currently speaking, I would suggest B-Wave would be the best choice just because it's cross-platform, it's more commonly used, it writes to the common B-Wave audio file that everyone seems to be using. So I would suggest that that would be the best way to write metadata to begin, and you can grow into proprietary formats and multiple fields of metadata from there.
Right. Well, good points. And with that, I think we've arrived at the final question for now. And let's zoom out a bit. And I want to ask you, where do you see indie sound effects going the next perhaps 3 to 5 years or so? What's in store for us?
I think that's a pretty tricky question to answer, actually, just because things have changed so much in the last 2 to 3 years alone that predicting the future is kind of tricky. I believe, of course, the pace of creating and releasing sound libraries will continue to pick up. I think that eventually there will be saturation with a number of different topics, so things may cool down a little bit. But what I hope to see is that sound library creators will start to offer a more creative spin on field recording and on sound design libraries, something that represents the sound creator themselves. as opposed to relying on the technical specs. And I guess that isn't much of a prediction and more about what I would personally like to see and what I would find inspiring and I think would be helpful for other sound library creators. But I'm hoping that's something that we'll see in the future.
All right, Paul, it's been a huge pleasure to have you here and hear your sage advice. So thank you very much for doing this.
Thank you so much for having me back on the A Sound Effect podcast. It's been a pleasure to be here.
Last fall, I went to the Greek island of Crete. I didn't really go there to record. It was just a family vacation, but of course, I brought a little bit of kit. And so here's a little montage of sounds I got and various little problems and mistakes I ran into. I hope you'll enjoy this little travel montage. So, I've been traveling again. This time it was a family trip to Crete, what I believe is the largest of the Greek islands, smack dab in the middle of the Mediterranean. And of course I brought recording gear. So what we're talking about is my Sony PCM M10 recorder and some small electret microphones. You know, the usual primos that I'm always babbling about. Since this was going to be a family trip, I knew I wouldn't be able to record as much as I did on the trip to Japan. Luckily, there are lots of interesting sounds in Crete. First of all, we're in the Mediterranean. If there's one thing you can count on, it's cicadas at night. I wanted to get a more clean recording of those cicadas, and there was no way of getting that around the hotel. Too much AC noise, too many cars, too much buzzing of the local highway, too many bars playing loud music, and so on. And at the same time, I was kind of reluctant to go up in the mountains at night. I'm not used to driving in that kind of terrain, and just doing it in daylight was challenging enough. So I compromised and just went up some of the way, unfortunately not far enough, and I couldn't get a quiet recording of cicadas. I did, however, get a recording of a small village at night. Just the street ambience, with faint voices heard inside the houses, some dogs barking in the distance, and so on. Another soundscape just not obtainable in Denmark, certainly not in the same way. I discovered something else I wanted to record. The moment you turn away from the beaches and the resorts down there and you drive inland, you hit the mountains. I think almost no matter where on Crete you are. So wherever there was a little bit of a flat plateau, there would be olive trees or wine. And wherever any sort of crop was impossible, you would find sheep or goats. So naturally, I had to record these bell sheep, as I called them. Yeah. Another thing of interest that I found in the mountains was something that we pretty much don't have in Denmark. Near complete silence. And we're talking in the middle of the day. All you had to do was turn around a bend, step out of the car, and walk a few steps, and just stand still. If you were just 100 meters up from the ocean, and not immediately near a village or a farm or something like that, it would just be quiet. Often there was very little wind, just maybe some flies buzzing around. So of course I wanted to capture that, but I made a mistake. First of all, I set up my gear with way too low gain. I guess I'm just used to sort of taking precautions for sudden loud sounds. But short of a landslide up there, there wouldn't be any loud sounds if you set it up in the right place. I got way too much hiss. And yeah, those mics aren't the quietest either. They're pretty good for small, cheap electrodes. But they don't come anywhere near my Sennheiser MS rig. So that was a missed opportunity. I learned from that and turned up the gain a bit for some other ambiences, which also happened to contain a little more sound. In the end, I came home from Crete with somewhat fewer recordings than I had hoped for, and somewhat lesser variety. But at the same time, I came home with a very clear idea of what I would go for should I ever return. For me, sometimes the best recording excursions are the ones that make you want to go back out for more. So depending on how you see it, that's either a lame excuse for failure, or you could see it as a reflection on how to do better next time. So what else did I learn from this trip? I guess the events as they unfolded on this trip just reinforced and underlined the importance of having enough time. Scouting. In this case, I didn't really know my terrain. At least not what I considered the most interesting part of my terrain. Going up in the mountains at night with almost no experience in doing so is, well, could be dangerous. So I guess I did what I could under the circumstances. It'll probably be a while before I get to go back to Crete, but I certainly want to. I guess in the meantime, I feel inspired to uncover and seek out sounds in my own country that are distinctly Danish. That should be an adventure in itself.
All right, that's it for this episode. Hope you've enjoyed listening. See you next time.
Yeah, see you.